first heard Rhianna Brown speak at an AFL Players Association leadership conference, and she spoke about some of the trends that she's seen around the future of women's sport, concussion, mental health in sport. And after she spoke, I made a beeline for her and said, I would love to get you on the podcast. So it's been an incredible chance to sit down and pick Rhianna's brain and learn more from an incredibly intelligent person. She's an academically trained and practicing futurist. I'll let her explain to you what a futurist is and what they do. And she's also got an incredible career in cricket. She's got a background as an elite cricketer, working as both an athlete, coach, and game development administrator. This was an incredible chance to sit down with Rhianna and really challenge some of the assumptions that people have held onto about women in sport and how that often shapes the decisions that are made moving into the future. I hope you enjoy this one. Rhianna Brown, welcome to the Female Athlete Project.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this chat. I got to hear you speak at a recent AFL Players Association delegates conference about the future and being a futurist. But before we get into that, can you give us a bit of a background? You've got quite an impressive sporting resume. Can you give us a bit of a background? Take us back to your childhood and we were talking earlier off air about your long travels to pursue this career.
I don't know if it's that impressive as a sporting background, particularly in the company I keep right now and all of the other athletes I'm around. My partner is a former athlete, our friends are. I grew up in a regional part of Queensland. Sport was like the heart of communities. I think it still is, actually, a random side fact, that when local sport declines, it's a lead indicator of declining community.
Wow.
Which is really interesting. But yeah, it's part of that thing of growing up regionally where you just play any sport you can. My dad was a jockey. My brother was a jockey. My sister-in-law was a jockey. So horse riding was the first sport in our house. But besides that, I was very keen on NRL, because mm-hmm. that's just what you do in Queensland. But, you know, the early story of you hit 10 years old or 11 years old and you can't play anymore. So I played a whole bunch of any sport that I could play, I played. It was cricket, it was softball, it was strangely netball. I think I hit my peak in about year 6 with netball, unfortunately. It was touch footy, soccer, anything that I think was in front of me, we played. But given that we're in a remote part of Queensland, our local region included Mount Isa, which was 6 hours away. So it wasn't uncommon to be, you know, every weekend driving a minimum of 6 hours just for your kind of semi-local competitions before you went to state titles. So, yeah, very different experience of sport. But for me, sport is the glue of regional Queensland, as I mentioned before, the glue of society. It's such an integral part of a healthy society. And for me, it offered really incredible pathways that you don't get outside of being able to play sport. And, you know, I was exposed to going to Brisbane very early in my life, like 6 or 7 times a year going to Brisbane for different sports. It was an expensive endeavour for my family, but it becomes a brilliant pathway and exposure to a whole new world outside of your little remote town.
Mm. Was there pressure for you to follow in the footsteps to become a jockey?
Absolutely.
Mm.
I think Dad said to me once, it's the biggest disappointment that I wasn't the jockey and my brother was, because he stopped riding maybe when he was about 15 or 16 because he just got too big. And I'm still probably small enough to almost make the weight, but I decided probably as I got to my teens, you have to start making a bit of a call. Some sports are ruled out, like NRL, though I have unfinished dreams and business of being a halfback for the Roosters, who I supported at the time. then I started to play a lot more cricket as I got to my early teens and exposed to early pathways with Queensland. I think I played my first under-19s Queensland tournament when I was 12.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I didn't have a pair of spikes. I'm not even sure if I had any other cricket equipment other than a bat. But I'd never played on a turf wicket or anything like that. We didn't have a coach. It was like the groundsman at the time that would just throw balls to you.
Great.
Yeah.
Not great, but great.
Yeah, that's true. Sport's the pathway.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Wow. And you also had some national representation thrown in there.
Yeah, so I played state cricket from like 12 right up until senior women's cricket for Queensland. Spent some time in the UK playing county cricket there. Some time playing with the, I think they call them like the Shooting Stars, like the under 23s Aussie team for a while. And then in the off season, I used to play the sport that I actually loved the most, which was Gaelic footy. So to keep fit, a lot of cricketers would play Gaelic footy.
Oh.
And it was a sport that was really thriving in Brisbane at the time. There was two divisions for women, which was amazing. I think it was a lot more dominant than the AFLW was back then. So it was really thriving. I don't know what was going on at the time, but there was a lot of kind of Irish people living in Brisbane, and the league was huge. So I played that in the off season and really got into that as a sport. It was awesome.
Do you know if it's still thriving in Brisbane?
It's a good question. I don't know. I would suspect there's still a competition. There's also a big competition there was in Melbourne as well. It's kind of everywhere. When I lived in the UK playing county cricket, I managed to play a few games in the London League there as well. So it is everywhere. I don't know where the growth of the game is at now, but it's a brilliant sport. I always wonder, though, if AFLW had been as dominant as it is now as the primary sport, whether I would have got into that. But I definitely loved the shift from a game that went for 7 or 8 hours to a game that was kind of over in 45 minutes.
It's a long time, cricket.
Yeah.
It's a long day.
It is.
It's a long day. Let's jump into the juicy stuff. I'm so keen to unpack some of this. Can you tell me what is a futurist?
Sounds like a made-up term.
I had never heard of it prior to hearing you speak.
Okay. Some people have, I think, these days. A lot of people confuse it with, I mean, its historical roots is kind of the image of the clairvoyant, which is just absolutely not what we do. I describe myself as an academically trained and practicing futurist. So I'm studied a master's in this, studied both in Australia and in the UK. Part of the work, I guess, is less about what we think it is, which is predictions, trying to get the future right. And I think the work of the futurists is, for me at least, more about conversations about change. It's about, you know, how do we actually think differently about change? How do we anticipate change? What have we assumed about the changes that might happen in the future? When we talk about the future of any topic, we really only have two data points. So we've got data about all the stuff that's happened in the past, let's say about sport. We've got data about the things that have happened in the past around sport. We've got data about what's happening today around sport. But we don't have data on the future because the future hasn't happened. So we've only got data, and most people in the future space will do work around that. It's like trends, right? We talk about trends, what's happening in sport. The other bit of data that we have around the future is our ideas and images. What do we think the future of sport will be like? And those two data points, I guess, are the two key things that I do work around. Talking about what's changing, what has changed over time, but also talking about what do we want to change? What are we imagining when we're thinking about sport? What are those ideas and images that shape how we act today? And that's kind of the neat space, I guess, of working around those two data points with people and helping them step away, ask questions about change, think about what they want to change, and then acting. You know, how do we move from where we are today to where we want to be in the future?
One of my favourite takeaways from hearing you speak was this principle and this idea of when you change how you think about the future, you change how you act in the present. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, I kind of got to this point after about 10 years in this space, and I used to think, if only I can come in and tell people about the trends of what's happening, that they might do something different. But no one does. You know, I don't think data really changes minds anymore. So what I worked out is, to do good futures work is to really get people to challenge how they think about the future in the first place. So we have a lot of assumptions about what the future is and how it happens, and they shape our views about action in the present. So a really good one is that, you know, that we think that the future is something that's out there and down the track. It's like the future of women's sport is in 10 years' time, but the future never arrives because we're always in the present. Right. So that's so
it's kind of weird to get your head around it, though, isn't it?
I know. It took me 10 years to even understand that concept. But this whole sense that if we think the future is out there and down the track, then we start to plan with that in mind. When I used to work in cricket very early on, and we were talking about the future of women's cricket, for instance, we'd often speak about it as if it was something that would eventually kind of arise. But we never get there. So the future is shaped by our actions and our inaction in the present, because all the things we don't do shapes that. So that's one way of kind of flipping our assumptions, and how we think about the future shapes our actions. You know, people say, oh, it's a long-term thing, but we never get to that because we never get to the long-term. We're always in the present. The other thing too, I think, is a couple of key assumptions that shape how we think about the future, which shapes how we think about action, is that the future of anything, let's say again sport, it doesn't exist. So Professor Jim Dator uses the quote and the line that there are no future facts because the future doesn't exist. It hasn't happened yet. And when we think about that and step back, it's just like, what? The way that we think about action is usually based on a sense that the future is predicted or knowable, that there are facts. When we're talking about the future, let's say of women's sport, if the future doesn't exist, what we're actually talking about is just our ideas and images, because it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Do you get pushback and questioning from people? How often are people willing to accept that versus kind of defaulting to those assumptions of it's long term, it'll eventually happen?
I think that's where I position my work, is to actually, I talk about the acupuncture point, is to just go and blow open all of the assumptions. People usually get that. And they're like, whoa, the future never arrives. We're always in the present. So everything I don't do influences my future. It's when we go to act, we tend to, you know, go back to our default behaviours of how we've done things before. So it's actually supporting people to act differently. But the other assumptions I think that are really important to think about is that I always talk about this idea that the future is likely to arrive via things that we consider to be ridiculous at first. So the best way to understand that, because people are like, always say to me, oh, that will never happen. I love listening out for this. I'll say, that will never happen. And then they say, oh, but that's an American sport thing. You know, that's not relevant to us.
That's a classic, isn't it?
Or it's not relevant to football or whatever it may be. And then they say, oh, that's normal. We've always been doing it. Athletes have always been, you know, advocating for things. We've always been, you know, talking about mental health and sport and how it's important. We haven't, for instance. So when I talk to people, I get them to think about the future, and I get them to challenge what we think might be ridiculous. And the best way to understand that is kind of looking at the past. And we've spent heaps of time talking about this, but when we think about the past of sport, or like the past of footy, we look back and some of it seems absurd now. I laugh with my friends all the time that any time we would get any media, it used to be the headline would be like, you know, sister of a jockey makes the Queensland team for blah, or my friend had her brother was a really good NRL player. It was always like the article was always about him, and then somehow she was mentioned as a kind of subsequent thought. Yeah, but I mean, that's one version of how this sport was ridiculous. I don't know. Are there things that you can think of where you think, I just can't believe that we used to do that in sport?
Oh gosh, I'm sure there'd be plenty. I should be able to think of one off the top of my head.
I mean, we used to like watch the old footage of, you know, they'd be like drinking beers at lunch, or Like, there is no way.
Yeah, just like smoke like a cigarette at half time.
Exactly. Yeah, or, and again, it can be like objective things like wearing culottes, playing cricket.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, that was kind of outrageous. Firstly, they didn't fit anyone, so they were never fully done up because I think they were like designed for women in the 1930s or something with like tiny waists. But secondly, I think I still have scars on my knees either from like long-term sunburn or just grazing from how impractical they were. It's hard to imagine that you'd even contemplate wearing those types of uniforms.
Yeah, like we had scungies in New South Wales. Scungies, like I think all the states have different words. Like pretty much undies over your undies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we call them runners.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And like I was in primary school wearing like this and my school uniform, I had a white T-shirt and these red scungies. And it was like, what? Why am I running around in my underwear? Like, what's going on here? Doing high jump and long jump. Like, what a ridiculous thing that was.
I think my mum's generation, to use your term because it's a very vivid term, they also played like touch football or something in scungies.
Wow.
I think my partner talks about her mum playing basketball in scungies as well. I can't say scungies. I have to say runners.
The more that we say it, I'm like, is that definitely the word? If I got the word wrong, I'm pretty sure they were called that. I'm going to look it up after this and I'll make sure I edit it out if I got it wrong.
I think some people would say bummers. I think we used to say runners, but either way, like just outrageous.
Outrageous.
There's kind of no way that I imagine they would be as wide scale as like a standard uniform, not for like supreme elite athletes wanting to wear the bodysuit. I'm talking about just a standard like community level uniform. So those types of things, we look back and we're like, that's so ridiculous. But it's not just the things that we can see or the technology. It's also kind of our beliefs about things have really shifted over time. I mean, attitudes towards women in sport is a very good example of, gosh, when I was playing sport very early on, how radically different some of those attitudes are now, and just the kind of appreciation of the skill and the professionalism that just absolutely wasn't around. And it's hard to imagine that as a very dominant state still exists, but as a dominant belief system and narrative. So thinking about the only time that makes sense for us in sport or whatever topic is the present. Because we look back, it seems ridiculous. So the whole premise is that the future of sport is likely to appear ridiculous to us today. So what are some of those things that are like, we just can't believe that happening? If I was sitting there in the work that I was doing in cricket game development many, many years ago, like decades ago, the notion that I would be at a game of women's cricket only, not a curtain raiser, with my teenage nephew, who was there by choice for his birthday, with 85,000 people packed out the MCG, people would have said that is absurd. Like, there's just no way that we can see that ever happening. And part of it's important to unpack because what we consider to be possible shapes action. You know, so back then, no one was planning or thinking about filling the MCG because we didn't think that that was possible. So part of good futures work, I think, is how do we challenge what we think is possible? How do we push the edges? How do we show evidence where things could be very different in the future? How do we challenge what I say, like our range of thinkable futures? And remember, the future hasn't happened. So it's really important to have those discussions. And now how does that influence how we act in the present? If we have a narrow view of the future, our actions will be very narrow in the present.
Yeah, it's so interesting, this idea of if you don't think that it's possible, you think it's ridiculous, why would you try and work towards it? Because you yourself don't believe you could ever get there. So it would feel like wasted energy to work towards that.
Exactly. Exactly right. And I kind of think part of the work, I always talk about this idea of the politics of the future. So if the future is really just our ideas and images of a time later than now, because it hasn't happened yet, right, then who is shaping the story and the narrative and the conversation about the future? And Nab Jain has this lovely quote that she says, those with the least power to shape the future suffer its worst consequences. So who is in the room when we're talking about the future of sport, the future of women's sport? Who isn't in the room? Who has the loudest voice? Because we shape our images of the future of the game or women's sport, and then thereafter they shape us in the present.
Wow.
So I think that's a really powerful conversation that we need to have now, is what is our preferred future? What do we want to see more of? How can we be more imaginative? What are we narrowing in on? Where are there possibilities that we're not seeing? And now how does that influence action in the present?
And there's discussion around, obviously, at TFAT we do a lot of work in the athlete space, but there's so much room for improvement in officiating, coaching, at executive level, even just what you touched on there about who is sitting in those rooms. Those are the people that have the power to shape the future. It's really, it kind of like hits you a little bit when you look at it like that, because it's true. And the people who aren't in those rooms don't have that power. So when we talk about diversity quotas and things like that, it's not just to tick a box. It's because they have so much power, the people who sit in those rooms.
Yeah, and their assumptions and ideas and images about the future influence those decisions.
Mm.
And if those assumptions aren't challenged, if those assumptions are narrow, if those assumptions about the future are how things have happened in the past, then they will project a future that is more of the same. If we were sitting around 20 years ago talking about, you know, the future of women's sport and not having the conversation that was broader than how can we increase participation a bit more, we never would be where we are today. And I think part of that work is how do we blow open those conversations?
Mm.
And remember, I think uncertainty is less about what we want to happen, because part of the conversation about the future is this work isn't just about trying to get the future right. You know, people always say to me, oh, what are the trends? How can we predict the trends? And I say, like, that's interesting, but that assumes that the future happens to you and that you don't have any influence or agency over the future. Remember, it hasn't happened yet. So we do have agency to, you know, an influence to shape things.
Mm.
We do have influence to shape what is possible. And the Matildas are such a good example of in concrete ways, I guess, showing and expanding our visions of what is possible for women's sport. And I think that's where some of the work needs to happen now, is actually expanding the imagination, being more creative about what is our preferred future here. Not what might happen, you know, what's imposed on us. What do we actually want to see here in the future? And it's less about uncertainty about what that is. How we get there is, you know, that's the debate and the conversation. But if we don't think about that now, we never get there. Because we're always in the present, right? So we just never end up somewhere different if we don't think about being somewhere different.
Mm. Do you have a process or something practical that you implement to challenge assumptions that people have?
There's quite a few, but there's a fun little process that I use, and it's based on some of Jane McGonigal's work. I call it a flip facts process. So it's literally like a 2-second kind of game that you can play that shows that we all have assumptions about the world, and they're just that, assumptions. They're not necessarily facts. So what you do is you take a current fact, let's say around sport, and it's like an unquestioned truth, right? We don't even think about it. So let's say, you know, the idea that all athletes at the moment are banned from taking drugs. Or let's say the idea that all sports coaches are human. Or the idea that, you know, sport is gender-based. So there are three kind of core facts, right? Nobody really necessarily questions them that much. And what the game is to say, let's just create an opposite statement for that. So instead of saying, you know, Olympic athletes banned from taking drugs, we just flip the fact. We say, open to doping. Athletes can be open to taking drugs, whatever. Instead of saying coaches are human, we say coaches are AI. Mm-hmm. I'm just making up opposite statements, so you don't have to get it right. And instead of saying sport is gender-based, let's say, like, totally open, non-gendered sport. And what the game is that you take that flipped fact and you go and Google it, and you try and find what I call a signal of change, mm-hmm. so a concrete bit of evidence where that flipped fact actually exists in the present. So, are we going to do this?
I just got my phone out. Let's do it.
Okay. Right. So, we've got the three facts. Let's do the flip facts. So, athletes are open to taking drugs. So, it's like free for all. Coaches are AI. And sport is non-gendered based. So, what you do is open up Google, type it in, look for a news search.
Shall I find coaches are AI, shall I?
Yep. Okay. Now, I've just randomly chosen these three things. You could almost literally choose anything. Okay.
Okay.
What have we got?
I've got an article about an artificial intelligence tool to help Aussie rules football coaches make decisions based on real-time stats.
Aha. Uh-huh. So we've already got concrete evidence or a signal of change or a pocket of the future and the present, as I call it, where coaching is integrating and relying on AI tools.
Mm. And it's not that idea of flipping it so far to think that a robot is coaching the team, but it's like little hints of progress towards that direction.
Exactly. Although sometimes you will find the robot example.
Yeah. Whoa.
And that's the ridiculous future that I tell people to pay attention to. So let's have a look. So I flipped the fact of, let's say, like Olympic athletes being open to taking drugs, which again, an absurd kind of statement, and found an example, a concrete bit of evidence. The PayPal co-founder, Peter Thiel, is backing an effort to create Olympic Games that welcomes drug use instead of discouraging it.
Insane.
So it's like superhuman athlete.
Yeah.
Or the flip fact with sport and gender-based sport of, I think it's British Triathlon already have an open category,
okay.
an additional open category. But again, there's some signals from a few years ago now. I think it was the New Zealand weightlifter at the Laura Hubbard, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
At the Tokyo Olympics.
Yeah.
So there'd be heaps of signals. And the point of the game isn't that, you know, the Olympics is now going to be just a free-for-all from a doping perspective. It's not to say that that flipped fact or that signal will become the future. It might. That's what futurists do. We keep an eye on how they change.
Mm-hmm.
What it is to say is that we have assumptions and that the future never arrives, right? We're always in the present. But William Gibson has this brilliant quote, and he says, the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. So where are those little pockets of change that already exist today? And I find that really useful for two reasons. It challenges our assumptions. So as soon as someone says to me, we can't do that, no, I just flip the fact and I try and find concrete evidence where it already exists today.
Wow.
But also it gives us a hint of, you know, it expands our range of what is possible in the present. And it's kind of my favourite game to do, especially when I've got people that are really resistant to things in the room. Of,
I can see that would be quite fun.
Yes. We all kind of have assumptions about the future. It's based on where you grew up, where you went to school, your gender, a whole bunch of things. And that shapes our images of what isn't possible.
Mm.
Part of the work is to challenge those because they shape our action in the present more so than I think data on trends.
Mm.
It's what we believe is possible informs how we act today.
Yeah. From what I understand, a lot of your work is about reading and researching and staying up to date with a whole range of data and information and articles across a whole range of topics. But if we look at it in a sporting context, are there signals that you have started to see pop up or any examples that would be good to chat about?
My job, you're so right, it's like scanning for these signals every day. I think I've done this my whole life, to be honest.
Yeah.
I just fumbled my way into a profession that actually validates this as a process. But people that are curious about change do it a lot. I think you do it. You're always looking at articles and saying, oh, this interesting thing happened over here. So again, a signal is a small bit of, it's an event or, you know, a phenomena or a small kind of hint and concrete evidence of something that's happening that suggests a bit of a change.
Mm-hmm.
I look at thousands of them. I probably read 50 of them every single day. And part of the work is to say, now I've seen a pattern emerge. What is that pattern? But it all starts off with a bit of a signal. So some that come to mind, which I find kind of interesting, was the Climate Council report. So they spoke about the idea that you know, this link between sport and climate change, and what does that kind of mean, and how is it showing up now? But they spoke about the idea and also the fact, sorry, that prolonged drought in Australia has resulted in more shoulder injuries because sports played on harder pitches. It's a really good example of, and I always encourage people when they're thinking about this work, when you hear a change or you read a signal, you read an article, ask the question, so what, now what? So what, like, what are the implications for what we do now and what we might do? You know, does that shift how we think about our strength and conditioning? Does that change the types of grounds that we might want to play on, and in what location and where? Does it change the work of groundskeepers? I don't know.
Mm.
And now what? What might we do in the present? Do we want to just keep an eye on this, or do we actually want to start to implement some small little changes? Some other signals that came to mind, I'm really big on this, and it's a bit of a taboo in many ways inside sport, but a lot of signals around sports betting, which I think is kind of subtly and also overtly fundamentally changing the nature of sport. You know, 75% of kids between 8 and 16 believe sports betting is normal.
Wow.
A lot of kids, I think, have now grown up in a generation where they don't quite know the difference between sport and sports betting. 40 minutes of an NRL game and you get about 15 minutes of gambling ads, almost 200 and something unique ads at once. And I'm now looking at emerging signals of change where you can bet live on athlete biometric data. So I can't remember if it was squash, it was a particular sport where they were thinking about, or maybe they're already doing, but, you know, I can watch your heart rate live and make specific kind of, you know, micro bets around that. So the question for me is kind of, again, so what, now what? I'm not opposed to sports betting at all, but the question should be for those inside of sport, what does this mean for us? You know, does it change the nature of sport? Are we seeing increased harm amongst our athletes, especially young male athletes, the highest risk? I think athletes are, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 times more likely to have sports betting problem. What does that mean in terms of what we might do come Monday? Not whether it's right or wrong and whether to debate it. It's just saying this is the change that's occurring. What does that mean for us in terms of action? I think the stuff I've been following probably for about 10 years is concussion. I always use this line that a friend said to me once, you're my most and least favourite dinner guest in the same night.
And I think... Thank you, question mark.
I know, yes. You're welcome. I think it's because part of the work is to talk about the cool fun stuff, you know, the cool technology. And then part of this work is to talk about the changes that are already occurring that we don't want to talk about. And concussion is a really interesting one for me for a variety of reasons, as someone has also experienced concussion through sport. I think it's maybe like 7 or 8 years ago, maybe even longer, when I first went to the US and I really started to pay attention to their investment in flag football. Mm-hmm. I thought that's really interesting. But again, concussion is a very old issue. I always talk about this idea, and I think it's a quote from Andy Hines. He says, change is only fast. It seems fast because we're not paying attention, and we're taught to look twice as far back on a topic as we do forward. So concussion's been around since 1906 or something, with, I think it was like Teddy Roosevelt. This is a random side tangent, but it's a really interesting one.
I'm here for it.
When they first had college athletes playing NFL, essentially,
American football.
And they started to notice injuries, and I can't remember how they described it, but essentially describing not just physical injuries, but kind of changes in moods, right, and a whole bunch of things. And I think that was when they started to invest quite heavily in new equipment. So we saw like the introduction and the changing equipment requirements for American footy. And then there's a really, so we're on a trajectory for like a lot of intervention very early on. We're talking like early 1900s, I think, asterisk. Anyway, it was a long time ago. Then we went to, or they went to war, and returning from war, what that changed was attitudes towards sport and warriorship and pain and, you know, the toughness of getting up after a kind of a head knock, and it almost, right, regressed yeah, the conversation about concussion. Anyway, a random backstory is because I started to get really intrigued about what was going on in this space. Something that feels like it's been around for a long time because it has.
Mm.
But also I look at signals of when things inside a topic is also starting to change in different ways. There was a really fascinating signal. It was an article, and I'm a bit obsessed with this, and I'd love to do this at a, I think they've done it with the NRL, but how the demographics of American football have changed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all the conversation around concussion, around the obvious things, about the injuries and all the things that, you know, are obvious and in hot debate right now. But the thing I've been interested in how is how it's slowly and quickly, I guess, changing the nature of who plays the game. So I think it was a Washington Post article, and they spoke about the declining participation over time in football, but particularly in less liberal areas and among wealthier kids. So the more conservative you are, and less wealthy, the more likely you are to continue to or advocate or be playing NFL. And they've started to watch this kind of the changing face, I guess, of American football and who plays, which is really interesting. At the same time, I'm looking at signals of their investment in flag football and how that's really booming.
We'll be an Olympic sport in LA in 2028.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a signal. You're great
there you
at
go.
Signals.
Yes, I passed the test.
You're nailing the
yes.
signals.
Look at me go.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that's like, that's a whole thing in and of itself to say the changing investment. The point is that it's not whether things will exist or not exist. It's to look at it more richly and say, what are the changes and what can we do now? Mm. I think we were talking about it earlier, just some of the advancements in technology that are emerging in this space. You were sharing something?
Yeah, because I saw this post on Instagram and I thought of this idea of signals that I'd heard you speak about. And I think it's called the Q collar, and it goes around people's necks, almost like a horseshoe type shape, and it sits quite close to their necks. And from what I could understand, it's meant to have a role in preventing concussion, because we've got in Aussie rules, we've got mouth guards that are tracking the data around concussion now, where they're
yep.
building in the technology into the mouth guards. But from what I understand, this Q collar is meant to be a piece of equipment that helps to prevent concussion. I don't know the exact mechanics. I couldn't really understand how it actually worked, but a couple of NFL players have started to wear it in different sports. It's starting to become a little bit more prevalent. And I saw it and I was like, I started to wonder, what could that look like if an AFL player wore it? How could that work
yep.
if they're making a tackle? Could it get pulled? Can it actually help prevent incidents of concussion?
Yeah, that's a brilliant example of saying, here's a signal, and so what now? What?
Mm.
What does this mean for me in my context? You know, how could this be utilized in our context of AFL?
Mm.
Could we? Would we need to make adaptations? And what's one small thing we could do? Maybe we can go and find out about, you know, who's doing the tech? What does it actually look like? But there's some really, you know, at the same time, there's some challenging conversations and some exciting signals around emerging technologies in this space. I think it's just a hard conversation that we have to manage as part of players, athletes, you know, coaches, people that are involved in the game. I think it's been around for a long time, but change changes. And part of what I'm seeing is some interesting changes. I think there was a signal of was it a Sydney's girls school that is no longer playing AFLW?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they banned Aussie rules for concussion concerns
yeah.
from parents and staff, I believe.
Yeah. And I think part of the declining participation, I think, with the NFL and the investment in flag football was driven by primarily, I think, concussions cost in the competition.
Mm.
So again, it's like, it's not, people are like, oh, well, we want to keep playing. And I keep saying, it's not about an either or, it's about what's the information that we have and what are the decisions that we need to make right now.
Mm.
Where is there some emerging, exciting advancements in this space? And what does that mean for what we do right now? What are our small bets in a long game? Which is like, I always talk about small, tiny things. You know, are we thinking about certain investment funds? What are we doing from a research perspective? A whole bunch of things. that could become very useful as the conversation around and the issues around this space kind of emerge over time. But it's certainly the least favourite dinner guest competition, but I'm really paying heaps of attention to it because I think it's nearing a tipping point in many ways.
When I sit on panels, I think one of the most common questions I'm asked is, what do I think the future of women's sport will look like, or what do I hope the future of women's sport will look like? In your job and with your experience, how do you approach a question like that?
This is a classic futurist answer, but I always say, it depends. do you know, that reminds me of when we think about where women's sport is at now, and, you know, the notion of kind of getting heaps of people in stadiums, and that sense of that it's, some of this is actually old ideas. So I found this clipping, this is a random Rihanna sideshare, but I found this clipping from the paper from 1929, and it was a photo of a women's Aussie rules game between two pyjama factory workers at, I think it was the Adelaide Oval, and it had 41,000 spectators. And the reason I'm sharing that is because part of it, I think, is less about trying to say what the future will be or an end state of what I want it to be, and more a conversation of what do I want it to be? What do we actually prefer? What's some radical imagining? And I guess the point is that the story of sold-out stadiums is kind of an old one. It's not necessarily a new thing. But also, what's our preference here? Like, if we could sit back and design a preferred future of women's sport from scratch, what would we say? What would we include? It hasn't happened yet. So I actually think the work to be done is for radical imagination. And I mean not just like borrowing a future from men's sport. So I'm really big on this. There are components of men's sport and elements that are useful to think about as parts of a vision of a future for women's sport. But also, we always talk about this idea of like a borrowed future. I don't think the work is to mimic men's sport. I think we can draw from, you know, components from that, but I don't think the work is to mimic it. I think that narrows our vision of what is possible. I think women's sport brings its own unique value proposition. I think part of it is blowing open our assumptions. What are the edges of what we think is possible for women's sport? Because remember, if we have a narrow view based on what we think is or isn't possible, that shapes how we act and the investments that we do or don't make in women's sport. What would it look like if we just blew it open? Like radical imagining. What would we actually want to see more or less of? Not specific, like what's the end point, but what would we want to see more or less of? I think for me, that's the way I tend to talk about it, is what would I want to see more or less of. As a good example, I think it's not just about equal pay. And again, I think we get caught up debating the means, not the ends. The means being equal pay. I mean, that's important, but, you know, I think when we just talk about equal pay, we miss things that enable the system that helps women's sport to advance. Like, we don't invest in the business of women's sport. We don't invest sufficiently in the marketing and promotion of women's sport. I think I would want to see more investment, of which we can then start to reap the benefits from those changes and then have conversations about revenue generation. Do you know what I mean? It's like when we debate kind of an ends of equal pay, we actually don't allow ourselves to build those fundamental foundations that would allow for those very things. Yeah, I guess it kind of comes back to what do we want it to be? I don't know. This is a good question. What do you answer when you're on those panels?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I might look at it differently now. I'm learning a lot from you. And one thing that came to mind is, yeah, I think probably on that equal pay piece, like when we look at women's sport as a whole, there's so many people, and you and I chatted about this off air earlier, there's so many people that are engaging with it and coming along for the ride because it's about the advancement of women. And I see it as people love seeing women existing in spaces that they haven't before because it makes them feel empowered, like they could potentially do the same in whatever area that might apply to in their life. And so I think Yeah, just like stepping away from that idea of equal pay and just having to copy and paste in the men's game to realize that women could, if we're talking ridiculous futures, women's sport could bring in more money than men's in the future if it's done correctly, because there's this hugely untapped audience that hasn't been invested in, that hasn't received the exposure. So I like that for a ridiculous future.
I mean, there's a little flip-back game. I'm sure there are already pockets of where it already exists, where mm-hmm. women's sports bring in more revenue. But you're so right in that this is a conversation about sport and its future. This is a conversation about women and its future. And then what do they mean in relation to each other?
Mm.
What future, you know, are we just, is it just an extension of what we're doing in the present? Mm. What really blows open those assumptions? And I think part of this is, how do we create a collective and shared image for that future? For me personally, I think sport is a really powerful setting for social change and health. You know, what happens when you start to think about women's professional sport through that lens? Like, mm. Part of this is both personal and collective, and how do we make those images shared? How do we make sure who gets to talk about women's sport, where that's diverse and we have other people in the room? I think that's equally as important. When we're having conversations about what we want the future to look like, who's in the room, who's not in the room,
mm.
who's got the loudest voice, and what are they saying?
Mm.
And do we need to challenge that?
Yeah, I'm loving it. Every time you chat about these things, I feel like it's a very empowering thing. And again, it's shifting this idea that even though you might feel like a tiny little fish, you can create change in what you want to do. And I'd love to kind of wrap up with the people that are listening that might love sport, might not love sport, but how can people actually practically do something if they've listened to this and felt like, oh yeah, I like this? How do you actually practically apply something like that?
It's such a good question, because I think good futures work leaves people with a sense of agency
mm.
and pathways, not overwhelm. And I think the favorite part about my work is when people step away and think, I can do something. You know, the future hasn't happened. I have some capacity to influence the future. I always talk about small bets, like, what's one small thing you're going to do come Monday? Mm. I sat on a gender equity panel recently, and there was like 700 women mostly in the room. And we were talking about the business case and how difficult it would be to advocate for the business case to pay women equally. And I kind of just got my book of notes and closed it and waited until the moderator asked me a question, and I didn't answer the question, of course. And I just said, I just want to say out loud what we're saying here. We're saying it's too expensive to pay women, i.e. you, fairly for the same work. And part of the provocation was to say, the future hasn't happened. You know, what is a preferred future? Because you're going to be inhabiting that. You already are. Mm. You're already being paid less. What are the small micro activisms that you can be doing right now come Monday? You know, and I'm talking about from a gender equality stance at the moment, but just kind of really giving that audience a sense of agency that they can do things. They make decisions every day. It's how they talk to their children. It's the jobs they decide to take. It's a whole bunch of things that influences the future. And the question is, what is the preferred future that you actually want? Is that one where in 10 years' time you're still advocating for the cost to pay you in the room fairly to do the same work? Anyway, the point of that, I guess, is that we do have capacity to shape and influence the future, our own, and then equally society. I fundamentally believe that even through very small actions, very tiny actions, you turn up to games, you follow the broadcast, you do a whole bunch of things. It's how you talk about women's sport. Mm. It's all of those things. I think some practical things, I think thinking about the way that we talk about the images of the future for women's sport and how we challenge them and how we have full permission to challenge them because the future hasn't happened.
Yeah, I love that.
It's my favorite thing. It's like I've done this work with lawyers once and they just couldn't argue in the end because I just said, that's your image of the future. Great. Ours is, mine is
good
different.
On you.
And that's the conversation is about the difference.
Yeah,
right?
Cool.
But the future hasn't happened. So you do have influence, you do have agency. What is the conversation that you're having with other people about what is possible for women's sport? Where are we limiting that unconsciously? Think about the ridiculous. So hold space for the ridiculous and challenge our assumptions every time we kind of narrow possibility. I love telling people to scan for signals.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of have this rule of three strikes. So the third time you hear something, start to pay attention. You're like, oh, that's the third time I've now heard this phrase or this technology or an athlete talk about blah. That's a really interesting thing. And then kind of practically this idea of small bets in a long game. So people always feel overwhelmed about change. You know, this is where I am at. This is where women's sport is at now. This is where we say we want to see more of and move towards. That feels like a big, heavy space.
Mm.
And I'm really big on to navigate that big, heavy space. What are the small bets in a longer game?
Mm.
And they are micro, you know, experiments, interventions, things that we test, things that we learn from that start to move us more towards the future that we want and away from the futures that we don't want. If we think about the best analogy is trajectory of a plane, if you change it by 2 degrees, you end up somewhere very different at the end. And all the work is to do is to think about, you know, what are those preferred futures for women's sport and what are the small things we're going to do come Monday to help move and turn the trajectory of where we are today.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for your time, Rihanna. I just love learning from you and listening to you talk about these things. As I said, I walk away from these conversations feeling like I can do really small things to create change. And I think that's a really powerful thing. So thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. I think the Female Athlete Project is a perfect example of something that is already creating change in the present. So well done. Big
Thank
fan.
You. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the time out to chat.
I loved it. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for listening. If you got something out of this episode, I would absolutely love it if you could send it on to one person who you think might enjoy it. Otherwise, subscribe, give us a review, and make sure you follow us on Instagram at The Female Athlete Project to stay up to date with podcast episodes, merch drops, and of course, news and stories about epic female athletes.